So I really see research and practice as kind of informing each other in a sort of a series of feedback loops. You know, one can't do great research if one doesn't know what's going on in practice. But one can't also be the best practitioner if one isn't keeping up to date with new research.
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hey, Jack here. Today we're going to dive into how effective ERP organizational change learning can be an invaluable tool for business readiness, continuous improvement, and value realization. All of us here at the ERP OCJ hope you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human element components of ERP organizational change. In this episode, we will discuss ERP organizational change learning with Dr. Lisa Giacomo. Lisa has worked internationally as an instructional designer, trainer, and manager for businesses, universities, nonprofits, and NGOs. Her research interests focus on the use of instructional design and digital tools for marginalized populations, global workplace learning, e-learning, and performance improvement. Lisa started at Boise State University in 2015. She is an associate professor for the Department of Organizational Performance and Workplace Learning. She is currently a member of the American Educational Research Association, International Society for Performance Improvement, and the Association for Educational Communications and Technology. Lisa also leads and develops organizational systems and individuals through collaborative partnerships, education, and training with empathy, transparency, and integrity to achieve strategic performance improvement outcomes. So let's dive in. We do know that ERP organizational change can be challenging. Effective strategy and alignment of a business within an ERP organizational change effort means addressing several factors, which often include empathetic design thinking, proper evaluation, needs assessment, individual interventions, alignments of the organizational culture, and meeting desired performance outcomes. So today we will learn more of how deliberate instructional and organizational learning design processes, with the help of state-of-the-art research and evidence-based practice, can contribute to your ERP success. Today, we will further explore these ideas with Lisa. Joining us from Boise, Idaho, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much. That's great to be here.
Yeah, and thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to this conversation and the great insight. Lisa, first, please tell us more, further introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you. Well, you know, you did a fantastic job, Jack, of introducing me. I'm just thrilled to be here. And I guess my newest addition to the introduction would be that I recently got selected to go to Florida this summer to live on Patrick Space Force Base and do some organizational research and consulting with them on their diversity and inclusion efforts through the DOME Institute. So I'm super excited about that too.
Yeah, very cool.
I'm going to add DOD to my list of contacts.
Well, that is awesome. Good for you. How fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, to start off here, my first question would be from an ERP organizational change perspective or an organizational change perspective in general, what would you say is the value of effective and efficient learning and development? Why should anyone care?
Well, leaders and organizations that engage in data-driven decision-making demonstrate stronger organizational performance time and time again. So when the L&D function is also aligned with strategic business objectives and also engages in this data-driven decision-making, it results, of course, in improved organizational performance. So I think that's why we care. And we can see this manifest in measurable and observable outcomes, such as improved productivity, increased organizational capacity and financial growth, improved nimbleness, improved customer satisfaction, increased employee satisfaction and retention, lower operational costs and risks, and improved succession planning for the organization.
And that's such a critical point that I wanted to share with our listeners. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, Lisa, with your response. And, you know, I think, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in the conversation, but I think too many organizations, or at least ERP plans, have zero to very poor L&D planning, you know, tactical planning within their project plan. And so I think that, to your point, it's a pretty critical idea as to why people should care, right? And the organization should care about effective learning and development. It's very powerful.
Yeah, I think that we're still struggling with how to demonstrate ROI sometimes on the accounting side.
Yeah.
But when you look into societal costs, strategic costs, the cost to the employees themselves, you can start adding up quite a huge return on investment just through your L&D function. It's not just a cost center.
Yeah, absolutely. Lisa, I know that you're an award-winning leader who partners with organizational leaders and engage them with, as I'd mentioned in the intro, empathetic design thinking, evaluation, and needs assessment. And as you said, you do that as a way to determine the appropriate systems and or individual interventions, right? And to align the organizational culture, the business strategy, and the desired performance outcomes. So I'd like to peel back the onion a little bit on that comment. But to start, can you tell our listeners more about this idea of empathetic design thinking? What does that mean exactly?
Sure. So empathetic design thinking is really about centering individuals, and those individuals might be your customers, or if we're talking about the L&D function, they might be your learners or your employees. And it's about making decisions based on their perspectives. Mm-hmm. So by that, I mean, you have to go interview them. Maybe there's extant data in your system. What you want to know is you want to know what they are thinking and feeling. So what their worries and aspirations are, what makes a difference to them, what's their mindset, what's their character. What do they see right around them immediately inside of your organization, the physical environment? What do they see in the market? What do they see in their culture, wherever they're from or where they go home to at night? What do they hear? So what influences them? What do their friends and family say? Their friends at work? What do their bosses and coworkers say? What do they say and do? How do they appear to others? How do they behave in public and towards others? And what do they fear or get frustrated by? What are their barriers? And what are their wants and needs and measures of success? So, and what are their facilitators? And then, so that's the first step. But the other step of this is taking all this data that you amass and you aggregate it. And I think historically, we sometimes tended to aggregate into one large group, right? But in design thinking, I think we're recognizing that we become more effective if we're willing to aggregate into different buckets, right? And so then we create plausible personas. And so you no longer try to group everyone into one big group, but you allow for multiple groups. You allow for variations and differences between the groups. And you build on those variations and differences, this rich diversity, to find a wider variety of strengths in your organization and motives for progression. It's easier to align values this way. And you uncover more barriers to address, and you can decide which ones are most significant and address those head on. You know, when you allow for this larger and richer story to unfold inside of your organization. And you feed all of this into your design considerations, into your gap analyses, so that you're better equipped to align your strategic solutions with real, actual individual people needs.
What a great response, Lisa. I really appreciate that. And, you know, organizations really are. They consist of various groups, stakeholder groups. But at the end of the day, it's a group of individual human beings, right? So that idea of being empathetic to people's perspectives and perceptions, I think is pretty important and valuable. soliciting that feedback is a very useful tool or mechanism for positive change. And the various stakeholder groups and individuals, they're all motivated differently. They all have different levels of knowledge and experience, and they're all impacted differently from various organizational, let's call them settings or artifacts. So I think it's really important to understand that and have some perspective.
Absolutely.
So, Lisa, you share online that your work is grounded in state-of-the-art research and evidence-based practice. And then you mentioned that you keep abreast of trends, new practices, and updated findings on a regular basis. And I really appreciate that. I think as a bit of a practitioner, as well as an academic, I personally think that practitioners have a lot to learn from the latest research and evidence-based practice that we can learn from and share and discuss and apply to our fields. What would you say in terms of how valuable is it for practitioners to leverage current research and longstanding L&D principles?
You know, I think it's imperative also that they leverage this current research and longstanding L&D principles. We can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results, and we all want different results. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we need to do different things, right? And we encounter new problems and new opportunities as the years go on. So it wouldn't make sense to rest only with what we knew 10 years ago, 30 years ago, how many ever years ago. When we get advice from somebody else, we all want that advice to be current and up to date. So therefore, we also need to give advice that's current and up to date. And I really see research and practice as kind of informing each other in a sort of a series of feedback loops.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
One can't do great research if one doesn't know what's going on in practice. Mm. But one can't also be the best practitioner if one isn't keeping up to date with new research findings, because we're all kind of looking at our own personal TV screens, and we can kind of peer over at somebody else's TV screen and kind of try to see what's going on over their shoulder, but we're never going to get that experience. And the nice thing about research is that it has the ability to take huge patterns that more than just what one person can see and aggregate them and figure out what's going on, what's actually working, what's actually not working, what's just, you know, a novelty effect versus something that happens over and over and over and over again, mm-hmm. no matter yeah. what organization you're
right.
in.
Exactly. Right.
And we don't have that ability as individuals to see,
yeah.
but we can when we start to access the research literature, especially when it's on based on empirical findings. You know, I always tell my students that one research study only proves what happened in one research
yeah,
study. And that's
exactly.
the same thing for practice. You know, you only know what happens in your practice, and you can be quite sure of what's going on in your practice, but you can't start to make decisions based on fundamental principles and theories that, you know, are able to get transferred and will apply and will make a difference as expected in different contexts without having that benefit of seeing into what's going on in other places too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. So it's fair to say then that evidence-based practice and I guess research across many orgs leads to sound fundamental principles, L&D principles.
Absolutely.
In my field of what we call ERP organizational change, I do think there's room to learn from the L&D experts and L&D research and to apply more of that to our approach to our trade. So that's a bit of a mission that I'm on, is to, you know, just really illustrate the value of L&D, and especially in terms of ERP organizational change, and not just L&D, of course, but effective and efficient learning and development. And I think it has a huge place in ERP organizational change success. Lisa, one of your areas of interest is organizational development and people development. And this includes such notions such as, you know, performance improvement, systems mapping and design, workplace learning systems strategy, and facilitation of workplace learning. In general, what tactical pointers can you share with our listeners in terms of facilitation of workplace learning specifically? What would that look like? Can you provide any tactical examples?
Yeah. So tactically, I think especially if you're talking, so are you talking from the perspective of like a mid-level manager who's in charge of getting resources and allocating resources.
Yeah, maybe if I'm an organizational leader, an executive, and I'm dedicated to saying, you know, hey, I believe in workplace learning. I want to promote workplace learning. How do I facilitate that? How do I actually make it get done? You know, how do I accomplish that? What can I do more tactically, you know, operationally? What can I specifically enact? You know, what does that process look like to make sure that happens?
I think it's getting a team together who's able to help you engage in data-driven decision-making that's aligned to strategic organizational objectives. So, and this data-driven decision-making means that whoever is going to be leading the L&D effort needs to go and engage in some of that empathetic design-based thinking that we were talking about earlier in this episode, where whoever's leading that function is really digging into the different groups in the org, what's hanging them up and preventing them from moving forward or being more effective, and creating programs and interventions that are specifically designed to achieve business results and address the specific barriers that are happening in those groups of workers at different levels in the organization. So the L&D leader needs to be able to get that information from multiple levels in the org, and they need to be able to select strategically the interventions. You know, learning and development training, for example, is one form of intervention that we can engage in as L&D professionals and create. But it only solves about 10% of the issues that you have for performance in an organization.
Yeah.
So without being able to access and resolve those other 80 to 90% of the issues that are blocking people from being able to do the good job that you hired them to do, then you're never going to be able to move forward. So when you're recruiting for that L&D leader position and leadership roles, you need to be able to tap into individuals who have a broader perspective on L&D than, oh, we're just going to create training. Because that's probably not going to get you where you want to go in the end of the day. It'll get you some of the way.
Yeah.
But we also need people who are able to, in the L&D role, look at other causes of gaps, you know, so information feedback loops, are they happening? Are incentives properly placed in the organization at different levels to ensure that they're aligned with people's values as well as the organizational values? Are resources being allocated appropriately at the strategic level, at the mid-level, at the individual level? Do people have what they need to get their jobs done? And then do they have the knowledge and skills, or do we need to upskill, or do we need to access more skill?
Yeah.
So hiring somebody who's able to see a bigger picture in your L&D area, I think is quite useful.
So Lisa, it sounds like the whole process is, number one, it's very intentional, right? It's very well thought out and considered, but it's also an iterative process where you are consistently considering stakeholder motivations, knowledge levels, and of course, as you'd mentioned, you know, organizational resources. Or maybe they're obstacles, maybe they're organizational obstacles.
Absolutely. Don't have to do everything at once. You can try to figure out what are some of the barriers, and then strategically select which you're going to go at first and, you know, where your low hanging fruit is, what's going to give you the biggest return for your efforts. And there's a lot to consider, but I think hiring somebody and tapping into talent pools that can get at a variety of different interventions.
So you mentioned, Lisa, there's a lot to consider, and I believe that to be the case for sure, and that a lot of organizations hire people that really understand this. Is it fair to say that in general, most organizations aren't equipped to do this on their own, that because it is, you know, learning and development, there's principles and there's good ways and bad ways to go about that, that it's really not something that's typically in an organizational toolkit without bringing in that resource to help kind of set the way.
Yeah, I think there's value in bringing in outside consultants. You know, an outside consultant is impartial. They're a little bit better able to solicit, I think, information that's might be there, but more hidden than an internal person sometimes. Mm-hmm. Although they'll need to talk to more people. There's fewer assumptions going into the situation. So getting third party help or outside consulting help to resolve issues or as a strategy to bring everyone to the table can be super useful.
And perhaps sometimes it can be a mechanism to maybe neutralize any internal politics that may prohibit.
Exactly.
And not that politics is always bad. I believe there's good and bad politics. And I think good politics, and that's a topic for a whole nother podcast, can have a place in an organization. But
absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, very interesting. Lisa, you contribute to a book called Workplace Learning, Big Data and Organizational Readiness, Where to Start. And I believe that was with co-authors Steven Villachica and is it Jerome Breman. Okay. I apologize if I didn't get that correct, but I thought it was an interesting article. Can you share more with our listeners specifically in terms of organizational readiness in this particular article? Can you maybe provide the main point to this article?
Sure. So there's a growing need for professionals who are able to analyze large data sets to inform business decisions. And, you know, this evidence is presented through examples of big data and analytics to inform and assess informal and formal workplace learning initiatives inside of this article that we wrote. And embedding the big data within a performance improvement framework to deliver an organizational readiness model. So it's really looking at trying to work across some of the traditional silos that you find in an organization. So the people that are able to set up and maintain and manage the business intelligence systems in your organization oftentimes aren't necessarily the same people that can, in your L&D function, that can help you think more strategically about how to upskill your talent pool or develop your organization, learning function and keep people retained and growing in their roles and responsibilities and engaged in their workplace. So we saw an opportunity to bring these leaders from different areas of the business together and really talk about, okay, so if you do want to leverage your business intelligence system and maybe outside data sources too, what are some of the things that you need to work through or think through as you're going to engage in this process? And so that's what we wrote that article about.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I'm going to share that article in our show notes. I encourage our listeners to read that. So really, I think to summarize the article, Lisa, is it fair to say that in terms of workplace learning, organizations can really leverage big data in order to promote organizational readiness for workplace continuous learning? Would that be a way to summarize the whole idea behind the article?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different areas that need to be considered. So, you know, your organizational culture, what skills you have, and then what you want to achieve. So it's quite complicated, I think, to determine readiness. But if you're going to start someplace, you should start with your technology, your culture, and then your strategic objectives.
Well said. And I couldn't agree more that organizational readiness and being able to assess that can be a pretty in-depth conversation, I would say.
Right. Yeah.
So I think whether adult learners in an organization or children in schools, Lisa, Can you share more about the idea of cognitive load? And I think you actually had a presentation. In fact, I know you did, titled Manage Cognitive Load to Increase Training Transfer. And that was I think you co-authored that article with Sabrina Johnson. Can you tell our listeners more about this idea and the value behind the idea of cognitive load and why that's so important in effective L&D?
Sure. So to facilitate building new knowledge, L&D professionals, instructional designers can work to avoid including information that's extra or unneeded, which actually can make learning harder or slower. And also, according to this theory, we can study to become more skillful at creating opportunities to acquire new knowledge with practice and feedback that are more authentic and closely related to what needs to be done later on the job. So, for example, instead of the e-learning with the quiz bank questions. Now, I understand sometimes you got to have your quiz bank questions for compliance reasons. But sure, going beyond that, or if you don't have to have it for compliance, throwing the quiz bank out of the window and really looking to see how people are performing on the job, right? So doing performance assessments versus knowledge assessments. Knowledge, it's fine if you know something, but it doesn't tell me if you're able to do it or if you are doing it. And these are three different, obviously, levels of skills, right? Knowing something, being able to do something, and then actually doing the thing. You know, the barriers could be that you don't have the resources to do it. So it's fine if you have the quiz to show that you know it, but if you don't have the resources to do it, what difference did it make anyway?
Yeah.
So that's what we're exactly trying to drive at, that to really get people to make use of that money that you're spending on your L&D function and to see return on your investment, there needs to be opportunities for them to get practice and feedback in situations that are really closely aligned with what's going to happen on the job. So it's fine to start with the e-learning, but at some point, we need to take it out of the e-learning and we need to get people practicing inside of an authentic context, doing the authentic thing, getting the authentic feedback that needs to be given to help guide their performance. And yeah, cognitive load theory is one way that L&D people can go about framing how they're working in that vein. And formally educated L&D experts can add to this people development because they know how learning can be supported and they've studied these evidence-based practices derived through research and experience. Planning for learning and development opportunities for transfer means that individuals are able to perform to expectations later on, long after the training or learning events are over. And it seems simple, but I've found that to do it well takes a lot of input and expertise about learning and organizational performance. And I'm sure our listeners have all spent time in training they felt was maybe wasted or not utilized as effectively as possible. But I'm here to say that it is possible to ensure that this time and energy is utilized well through careful planning and collaboration of highly experienced and skilled individuals.
Absolutely. That's well said, and I couldn't agree more. And you'd mentioned that there is a lot to effective L&D. And, you know, sometimes organizations perhaps do one piece of that well, but they neglect other pieces, or they're only familiar with one piece of that, but not others. For instance, I know there's multiple, let's call it training and or evaluation models, but one that comes to mind, and it's, I would say probably one of my favorites, is the Kirkpatrick evaluation model. And that's where you got to ask the various questions. And, you know, so for instance, the Kirkpatrick model, it talks about reaction, right? That the users enjoy the training. And then you've got to ask and think about the learning piece. You know, did the learning transfer occur, as you'd mentioned, Lisa? How effective was the learning? And then really your learning is a primary objective of learning is to help with a behavior, right? To change a behavior and knowledge. So did the behavior change? You know, was what they learning, was that transferable to their workplace? And then what's the result? Did the training influence your organizational performance? And, you know, we briefly talked about this idea of using data and SLAs, you know, service level agreements and KPIs, key performance indicators and metrics. So, you know, there's multiple levels of managing effective learning and development, and every piece is important to ensure that it is effective and efficient for the organization.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some people, you know, they look down on the, what we used to call the smile sheets, right? Did you enjoy
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that, like you said, I think what you made is a great point. Like, it is important that people enjoy it, because if they didn't enjoy it, they're not going to pay attention to it. If they didn't pay attention to it, they're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
That's really what you want them. That's why yeah. we used to look at, you know, those sheets. But it is important to push beyond the did you enjoy it into, like, how has this changed what you're able to do on the job now? And
exactly.
let me see you. What does it look like? What, you know, what's still hard? What's become a lot easier?
Yeah. And I think that is important, just the reaction of the end users. I mean, if they don't appreciate the learning, or they're not motivated to learn, maybe even. But I guess if their reaction is poor and they don't enjoy the training, then how effective is it going to really be at the end of the day? And yeah, the old smile sheets. But, you know, there's various forms to determine the reaction, whether it's a questionnaire, or various scorecards, or, you know, post-training surveys and so forth. But I think there's a variety of ways to measure that reaction, you know, with the training. But you know, I think that is one of the steps of effective L&D that are often left out of the whole process.
But
I think it's pretty important idea.
Yeah, going out on the floor and see what does it look like? How are things going with the people?
Yeah. Asking questions. And, you know, in a way, Lisa, that kind of goes back to your idea that we talked about earlier, is just empathy, right? Just understanding the people, understanding their context, you know, soliciting their feedback, so you can get reaction that way as well, right?
Absolutely.
And I think it's a pretty powerful idea.
And not to assume or make decisions based on what you think people might like. What I've learned through my career is that what I enjoy and what I think might be enjoyed by others isn't necessarily always what others think. And it's really, really important to get in touch with what others are thinking and look for those larger patterns and respond accordingly, and let them know that you're doing that also. You know, that goes a long way to winning people's trust and desire to do more and to work with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Lisa, I would like to ask you to share an article that you published, you were co-author of, and I believe it was 2017. And it was called Presentation, Mentoring, Workplace Learning, and Performance Improvement, Evidence, Evaluation, and Research Methods Updates from a Multiple Studies Review. I know that was a mouthful, but can you maybe just break down for our listeners the purpose of that study and maybe what the conclusion was?
Sure. Yeah. The purpose was to, again, we were talking a little bit earlier about how, you know, sometimes we're really only able to see what on our own TV screen, you know, learn from our own history, our own mistakes. But when you start looking at a lot of different studies and a lot of different organizations, you start to see patterns that jump out at you. And then you start to realize, okay, there are some fundamental things that are perhaps, no matter what context, I can probably lean into them and they're going to give me the desired results. So that was the purpose of this article, to try to start taking a more systematic approach and systemic approach to looking at what needs to go into mentoring program design. Mentoring programs can help you meet a lot of strategic business objectives, but not all. There's a lot of consideration, again, that needs to happen in order to implement them effectively and get the results that you're hoping for. And one of the key points to mentoring systems, oftentimes they're there to support organizational culture and help build organizational culture, help ensure better retention, as well as knowledge and skills transfer to incoming or to rising employees and leaders inside of organizations. But if you don't take the organizational culture into consideration, the outcomes that you're driving towards inside of the organization, and you don't feed those into your design considerations, chances are it's not going to hit the mark.
Yeah.
So that article, the purpose of that article was to help people who want to either start a mentoring program or make changes to their mentoring programs so that they're starting to realize all of the potential results that they could realize, to help them think about you know, what are the top 10 things they need to consider? And if you're going to set up a program or add to your program or change your program somehow, what are the things that need that probably should go into place that are tried and true evidence-based practices?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciated the article, Lisa. And once again, I think there's lots to learn from that type of work. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I mean, evidence-based research such as that really helps substantiate what is effective and efficient L&D practice.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, you know, we started the conversation off by talking about, you know, effective L&D principles. And what does that mean exactly? And how do we know for sure? Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned it yourself that there are. I mean, when you look across various organizational contexts, or when you look at, you know, multiple studies, or and you kind of look at the big picture, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's fair to say that there's certainly foundational principles that can help guide effective L&D practice.
Yeah.
Is that a true statement?
Yeah. And I think in the past, especially with mentoring program, there's been a lot of theory. There's been a lot of postulation. But there hasn't been a lot of looking at the evidence, looking at empirical results. And so that was the value add of this article. There weren't any reviews that looked at many different examples of what happens when you have a mentoring program. What was great about it? What didn't work so well?
Yeah,
that's where that practice and research, you can't do good research without having good practice, but you also can't have good practice if you don't consider the research, or you can, at least you're not going to get state of the art practice anyways.
Yeah. And I think, and Lisa, you'd actually mentioned this once or twice in this conversation, you know, as practitioners, we just can't simply rely on our own experience alone. I mean, even if as a practitioner, you've had some wins, let's call it, you know, along the way and made a difference in organizations, you can't just always rely on your single context experience.
Absolutely.
You know, because every organization is different. And, you know, if you're sticking to those, I would say L&D principles, that's one thing. But, you know, at some point, what you do as a practitioner in one context may not apply very well in other contexts. But there are principles that do apply across contexts that are quite effective. So,
yes.
Interesting. Well, Lisa, it's been really fun to share some of these pointers and ideas and insights with our listeners today. I think we could talk for quite some time, and we could probably take any one of these questions and spend an hour and drill into these a little bit more. But before I let you go for today, I have another question that I like to ask all of our guests. And I believe we've actually done this since we've started our podcast. And that is, if you can leave our listeners with a nugget. So if you were going to give advice to an organization regarding successful ERP implementation or effective learning and development, for that matter, as a tool for business continuous improvement and value realization, what would you say in terms of learning, leadership, and culture? How would you summarize this conversation for our listeners today?
Yeah, so I think it's best if you can look for someone who can give you evidence-based practice advice that's data-driven and researched and formed with rationale, research-informed rationale for L&D decisions, and knows how to collaborate with other business leaders to meet strategic business objectives. That would be my one bit of advice. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted to say is hire one of my graduates, because they're powerful and effective and they know how to do that. But I thought I could save the shameless plug for the second.
There you go. Well said. That's great. That's awesome. Lisa, thank you so much for your time today. I really do appreciate your dedication to your trade and to this field. So thank you very much for that. Can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you? I know you're very busy and you have a lot going on, but is there a way that if our listeners want, they can reach out to you to learn more?
Absolutely. Please connect with me on LinkedIn. I think that you're sharing my profile connection in your materials. So I'd love for you to get in touch with me. And also we have the MARC Lab. If you're interested in working with us and collaborating with us, We consult with organizations, but we also bring members into our community to help out with work. So if you're looking to upskill or get some experience doing something different than what you've done before, a stretch assignment, and you're not sure how to do that in your org, you can come play with us in our sandbox. Or if you need some help, you can hire our professionals to support your efforts and achieve your goals.
That's great, Lisa. Thank you. And we will absolutely be sure to share out that information to our listeners in our show notes.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Lisa, thank you again. And we really appreciate it. Be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, you too.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.